आत्मा त्वं गिरिजामते सहचर प्राणशरीरं गृहं पूजाते विषयोपभोगरचना निद्रा समाधिस्थितिः संसारपदयो प्रदक्षिणविधि स्तोत्राणि सर्वागिरो यदि यत् कर्म करोमि तत्तदखिलं शम्भो तवाराधनम्. O Lord, may we realize that Thou art the soul of our soul, that it is Thine energy which is functioning as our mind and intelligence. May our bodies be Thine abode, and may all our enjoyments be as offerings unto Thee. May our powers and desires be the companions of Thy will. May our lives be the instruments of Thy purpose. May our every word be a hymn unto Thee, our every act Thine adoration, our every step a pilgrimage to Thy shrine. And may we realize, O Lord, that all we see is lighted by Thy light, that the universe and all its beings are Thy very self. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Ma Vindishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being May the Divine Being support and nourish us, the Mother and Father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Good morning. My topic today is the meaning of life. I don't know why you're laughing. It's a serious matter. Well, granted, it could be the name of a whole series of talks, but why are we here? Sometimes I talk on this subject. Animals don't ask this question. For them, life is programmed pretty straightforward and pretty simple. Avoid your enemies, get your food, find your mate, procreate, climb the tree or swim in the ocean or whatever. They don't have to ask what's the meaning of life. We had a good friend who was with us for a few years, some years ago, and then dropped out. And I think one of the reasons she dropped out was because I refused to grant her that her pet cat wasn't more intelligent than human beings. She claimed, and I think with some justification, that her cat was smarter than she was.
Yeah,
And I wasn't going to allow that. And the reason, of course, is obvious. The cat doesn't bother with what the purpose of life is, because it's a matter of gratifying whatever urge comes up and need arises in life. You know, I go out sometimes to schools, to colleges and schools. I remember going to a high school one time where I put on the board to get to break the ice. They always want to know about Hinduism. Well, I have to tell them first of all, well, I talk about Vedanta. I don't talk about Hinduism much. And then I get to break the ice, and so I put on the board, what is your answer to this question? What is the ultimate purpose of life? And you know, it's hard for those people at that age to understand what the word ultimate means. And they give me all kinds of funny answers. Not funny answers. They give me all kinds of reasonable answers, like procreating the species, or finding happiness, or having success, leaving the world a better place than you found it, making your mark on the world. All of these answers come from our young people who are looking for, perhaps, and not looking for, the answer to the question of the meaning of life. Well, I want to take up some of those and perhaps poke holes in them or whatever, deal with them in some way or other. First of all, happiness. I think that the most common answer in the schools to this question, what is the purpose of life, is finding happiness, becoming happy. And by that they mean happy for a long time. Not happy forever, but happy for a long time and as soon as possible. And I like to point out to them that in the old comic strip, which most of them remember, called Peanuts, for Lucy, happiness was a warm puppy. And for Schroeder, it was a piece on the piano. And for Charlie Brown, it was... What was it for Charlie Brown? A good baseball team. And for Peanuts himself, it was the chow bowl. So you see, our definition of happiness changes so much from person to person, and from time in our life to time in our life, and from condition of our health to a condition of our health. Happiness means quite a different thing for a person suffering from a terminal disease than it means to a young person just starting out on his or her first job. Well, Vedanta has a very definite answer to this business of happiness. It says, Nalpe sukham asti bhuma eva sukham. There is no happiness in the petty. Alpa. Alpa means small, if you're talking in terms of physical size. And bhuma means vast, infinite. But better words translated, petty. There is no happiness in pettiness, or petty things. Things which are small, which last short time, which are encompassable by something else. The bhuma, the incomprehensible, the unencompassable, the extended, the vast, the infinite, alone is happiness. That's what the Chandogya Upanishad says. We give our definition of that. So if you are looking for happiness, there again, happiness will only be attained when we can find the infinite within ourselves, or ourselves within it, whichever way you want to frame it. How about success? Now that's another one that you hear very often in the schools. The meaning of life or purpose, ultimate purpose of life is success. Well, you know, success is awfully hard to measure. And then again, how long does it last? I may be successful in passing an examination and never get a job from it. I may be successful in getting a job and then have myself fired after a short time. I have no idea how long success will last, nor do I know exactly what it means. Usually they're talking about financial success, money, getting a secure position, which will secure me a good income, or they're talking about fame, success in becoming a popular singer, a popular performer, a popular writer, and so on. Somebody who wants to be known, success that brings them in an income. I'm sure that Harry Potter's author had no idea of the success that she would get. I have no idea whatsoever, but I'm sure that she started out hoping for some kind of success. And then another very popular one, I think when I have talked to the school students and we have discussed how temporal, how uncertain are the goals that they propose to me for the meaning of life, we talk about that, and they seem to see that after all, death does come. It's going to terminate whatever money we have. Can't take it with you. And all those phrases come back. You can't take it with you. And they see that the temporariness of this life is paramount. Very often the next answer will be, I want to leave my mark on the world. Now, think about it, you know. You want to leave your mark on the world. Are you going to be able to know what kind of mark you have left on the world? Are you going to be able to sit somewhere afterwards, you know, up in heaven? You see, this is the kind of childish ideas that still cling to intelligent college kids. Up there, somewhere in heaven, you're going to look down and see that the world has been different for my life. I look at my life, I see that the world... Sit down, please. Come, you have some chairs here. I look at the world and I see that my life has been altered by the presence of my having been here. How are you going to know that you left your mark upon the world? Even if you think you did, from when you pass away, and you see, look back and you think, ah, you see what I did? Look at the life of J. Edgar Hoover. I am sure that J. Edgar Hoover was certain that he had left his mark on the world. And it was a very good mark that he had left. Look at the infamy today. J. Edgar Hoover is known as a demagogue, a liar, a person who defrauded. He's known as a fascistically minded bureaucrat who did a lot of damage to a lot of people. That's the mark that J. Edgar Hoover left on the world. But I'm sure that he didn't think so. Now, how do you know what mark you're going to leave on? So that's a serious consideration. Well, another chapter in the Chandogya Upanishad, from the one that talked about Bhuma and Alpa, another chapter is Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma. All this is Brahman. All this existence is Brahman, the highest being, from which one comes forth. Now, mark the words. We come forth from a common source, the vast, infinite, immortal Brahman, consciousness, pure consciousness. All this is Brahman, from which one comes forth. Tranquil, let one meditate upon it. Tranquil, don't be disturbed. You've come into the earth, come into the world. Don't be a crybaby. Be tranquil, meditate on that. Now, a person consists of purpose. The Sanskrit word is kratu. Kratu means, in our nearest equivalent in English, purpose. A person consists of purpose. According to the purpose he or she has, well, it says he here, I have to read it to you. According to the purpose he has, so does he become when he departs. So let one frame a purpose for oneself. Now, I think this is one of the most important verses in the whole of the Upanishads. I really do. I think it's one of the most important. I'm going to read it again. Try to memorize this now. A person consists of purpose. According to the purpose he has, so does he become when he departs. So let one frame a purpose for oneself. In other words, the purpose of life is a life of purpose. When we depart, there are two paths by which we go, says the Bhagavad Gita, either the path of non-return, so do the Buddhists, the path of non-return, or the path of returning. And since our scriptures describe the process of reincarnation, we accept that as our picture of the afterlife. Unless you have become freed, unless you have become transformed by the process of living up to your purpose and become a knower of Brahman. If you are a knower of Brahman, then at the end of your life, when you depart, you enter into that same Brahman which you have been aware of throughout the end of your life, throughout your maturity. If you have not become a knower of that God, that Brahman, you'll have to return. Like in college, you don't get out till you're a senior. You don't get out when you're a junior. You don't graduate when you're a sophomore. You have to come back, take some more lessons. So life is forming purposes and learning to work them out, life after life after life, until you discover the ultimate meaning, and then you can depart into that. Well, now that's I could stop there, but I have to fill up the hour, so we have to go on. So, does this mean that each one of us has his or her own purpose? We don't have any common purpose? Well, let's come to that. If it were true, how could I presume to talk to you? I couldn't presume to give you any sermon or any discourse. If each of us has his or her own exclusive purpose, no, there are many purposes in common, and I'm going to be coming to that a little later, but the reason that I can presume is because I'm supposed to be, about these matters, omniscient. There was a little girl who was the daughter of a preacher. And one day, some lady came to the house and wanted to interview the preacher, wanted to have a personal interview. And she knocked on the door, and the little daughter came to the door. And she said, is your father home? I wanted to talk to him a little while. She said, no, he isn't home today. But what did you want to know about? I know the whole story of salvation from the cradle to the grave. So, I don't want to pretend to be like that. I don't know the whole story of salvation from the cradle to the grave. But I do know that there are similarities in this doctrine to the old, it's old now. It wasn't when I was young. The old school of existentialism. One of the doctrines, one of the very few actual pronouncements, it's hard to get doctrine or theology or even cosmology or anything from an existentialist. But one of the few things they did say was, you aren't even real until you have made a purpose, until you have made yourself into something. Until you have framed a purpose for yourself, until you have set a goal and become. Yeah, that was the whole idea of existentialism. You must become. What you were to become wasn't very clear, at least for me. But I know that there are in every great movement, it seems to me, in every great philosophy or everything that comes by us, there is some hint, some glimpse of the underlying truth. This truth of the that we have put out as Vedanta is so universal, it's so completely basic, that everything, almost everything that comes up has picked up some glint, some hint of the truths, of one of the truths or more, of this basic ancient philosophy. And existentialism seems to have picked up that idea that, what are you? They don't talk about reincarnation, but they say, what are you unless you have made yourself into something? And by something, of course, they mean worldly things, but maybe sometimes they meant more than that. Well, now I have to talk about one serious thing. I am going to get it over with before we go any farther, because this is the inevitable fact, and that's death. How can you understand the meaning of life unless you understand the meaning of death? How can you understand life without understanding death? They go together. You can't understand good except in relation to bad, or bad except in relation to good. These are words we use. We put these terms onto things that happen mostly to us, or in the world, or in elections, or wherever. We put the words good and bad. And life and death are in the same category. They go together. We don't want to think about death. We don't want to talk about death. We don't want to deal with it. We want to be, become. We want to success. We want to succeed. We want have purpose. So death seems to put an end to purpose, but it doesn't. No one can understand without considering death. So let's hear. I forgot to bring. Please excuse me. Oh, I can't get out of here. Could you look on the top shelf of my bookcase and find the Shakespeare collection? There's one volume. I want to read The Seven Stages of Man. I forgot to bring it. It's over on the right, on the left, I mean, far on the left, on the top shelf. You see Shakespeare there? It's just one volume. I guess I'll have to get up.
Do you want me to unhook you?
What?
You
want me
to unhook you?
No. He should find it right on the top. It's a gray book.
Well, it's one of those people that need to find things.
Oh, maybe I took it off. You better unhook me. You better unhook me. I might have taken it off. Is it on my table? Oh, she got it. He's got it. Okay. This is such a wonderful passage. Ah, right. Fine. Thank you. What's your name?
Smita.
Melissa?
Smita.
Missa?
Smita.
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 How do you spell it?
S-M-I-T-A.
Oh, Smita. Oh, we know Smita. We know.
Smita this way.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Smita. Thank you. And you know, probably some of you know it by heart, but some of our friends from India might not know it. It's from As You Like It. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. We saw that yesterday. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like a furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths, and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon laid, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on the side, his youthful hose well saved a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Yeah. And Macbeth, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more, the tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But it doesn't signify nothing. That's where Macbeth was wrong, of course. Swami Vivekananda has given us many wonderful definitions of life and its meaning, and I am not going to take time to give those to you today because most of you have heard them before many times. Years ago, when I was young, there was an election of a pope. This was John Paul I. And John Paul I became pope, was elected pope, and 1 month later he died. And people, that's why we have John Paul II. And many people wondered at that time, how strange, what is life all about when somebody can get up to the very top of the Roman Catholic Church and then die in a month? But I don't think in Vedanta we would have any problem, you see, understanding this. Most likely we'd say his purpose in life had been, perhaps his hope, his great hope, his great cherished hope was to be elected Pope. Not many cardinals do. Many cardinals hope that they'll be elected Pope someday and have that full power. He got it. Got what he wanted. Departed. Left. So sometimes this happens. We get what we want and we just go. Frame a purpose for yourself. That's what the scripture says. Well, every religion, every great world religion, has a scheme, has a system, a doctrine to avert the effect of death and assure us immortality. In Islam, paradise, with its fountains and all of the water that you want when you lived in a desert. In Christianity, heaven in one form or another, and all of the great religion, Buddhism, of course, nirvana, and immortality, and that, not immortality, but a blessedness which transcends all description. But you see, ours differs. Ours is a scheme which doesn't promise you eternal life. It defines life as that which is involved with the circular operation of death. If it's life, there's going to be death. If there's death, there's going to be life. Bhagavad Gita says, for that which is born, death is certain. For that which is dead, life is certain. Birth is certain. Whatever is born is going to die, and whatever has died is going to be reborn. Because this world is a complete circle. We recycle everything, including our own lives, according to our idea of it. Unless you have found the ultimate purpose of all our lives, which is, in a word, wisdom. I won't say knowledge even. Wisdom. Divine wisdom. You know, Swami Vivekananda once was challenged on the leisurely pace of his work. Somebody in the West asked him, Swami, why don't you get things organized? Why don't you stir things up a little bit, move along with your Vedanta movement, get it going. And you know what he said? He said, I am not in a hurry because I know that I can never die. So long as one ant lives in this universe, I live. This is wisdom. This is what we call wisdom. So long as one ant crawls alive in this universe, I am alive. I do not die. I am one with all of existence, with all being, with all life, if you like, even beyond life. I'm one with all existence, living or dead, moving or non-moving. He knew it. And so he said, I'm not in a hurry. I think that's a wonderful idea. And I suppose that's why I'm a Vedantist, because I think that's the most wonderful of all the ideas that I've ever heard in religion. I don't expect to hear a greater truth than that, that we're all in the great web of life. This is a vast, that's another Upanishad, the Mundaka says this. We're in the spider's web. The great cosmic spider has spun this web of existence, and you and I are the little particles, not necessarily flies, but we are parts of that web, you know. Some parts of the web are beautiful. They shine in the sunlight. They're not all caught spiders. We are all in the web of life. I like to think about bubbles. I really wonder why in none of our scriptures and in none of our texts, Vedantic texts, the illustration of soap bubbles hasn't come up. Because as a kid, I used to love to blow soap bubbles. And, you know, they come out iridescent, and beautiful colors, if you have the right kind of soap, come out, and they last, and they last, and then they go floating in the air, and you think, oh, what a beautiful thing I have produced. Poof! Gone. Just like that. Gone. Now, you say, they're ended. It comes, the bubble died. No. The bubble, as bubble, died. Yes. The form disappeared. The forms of each of us, individually, disappears at death. It's broken up. But you know, nothing really was lost. When the bubble burst, the water molecules went back into the air vapor, water vapor in the air, and the soap molecules, I presume they fell down to earth, or they onto the thing which pricked the bubble. They're not gone. So the elements or essence of the soap bubble is never lost. But the form goes. And we are all soap bubbles blown by the great child. And we live for as long as that great bubble wants to live. And something always pricks it. And so it is with us. I like this, and I don't know why. Well, it's my own invention, you see, so. Some people think it's morbid to talk about death. And I like to ask you, what does the word morbid mean? It means death. So, of course, it's morbid to talk about death. Right. Oh, mortgage. Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Mortgage. Okay. So, yes, we do dwell on morbid things, things which are morbid, belong to death. But that doesn't mean we have to think about them as morbid. We are the ones, in our foolishness, who make such a big deal out of this passing through the door of death. We make a big fuss about it. We make a big hue and cry and wring our hands and shed our tears over the passing of another soap bubble. And we really are responsible for giving death the color that it has, especially in the West. It doesn't have that color in India. And even in India, of course, it has not always a cheerful color. And that's, you know, the difference between science, Christian Science and Vedanta. I bring it up because a lot of people think that Vedanta is like Christian Science. Christian Science aspires to make a world which is all good and no bad, which is all virtue and no vice, in which mind has overcome matter and has superseded it and made itself immortal, and so on. That's not what Vedanta says. Vedanta says the pairs of opposites are always there together. Mind and matter are pairs of opposites, supposedly, and good and bad, righteousness and unrighteousness, a world of evil and a world of good, inseparable. So we don't have that kind of... We don't try to deny death. We don't try to assert an immortality of life without death. Well, look at Longfellow. What did Longfellow say? Life is real, life is earnest. And the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest. Was not spoken of the soul. See, he wants to make clear dichotomy between the soul and the body. As Christians usually do, body is dust, and to dust it returns, but that's not true of the soul. But then he doesn't go on to explain what does happen to the soul. And that's the way with most Western poets. I love poetry, and I majored in poetry, and I love it, and I think that some of our Western poets have great insight. But generally speaking, about the soul, they are fools. They just do not know what they're talking about. Mix it up with mind, or give it some kind of, I am the captain of my soul. What do you mean you're the captain of your soul? The soul is your captain. And be glad of it. Tragedy. The West loves tragedy. I don't know why. Our greatest heroes seem to have to be crucified, or they seem to have to be murdered. Look at all the people who are honored and put on pedestals because they were murdered. And how many books and plays we enjoy in the West end in tragedy. And somehow we revel in that, and we feel somehow uplifted. Many people feel uplifted by reading tragedies. Do you know there isn't a tragedy in Sanskrit literature? In the whole of Sanskrit literature, there is no ultimate tragedy. There are sad events, there are bad outcomes. Things that happen are not all good. But in the end, the highest truth, the highest being, the highest existence prevails. The highest truth prevails. Can you think of a con? Can you think of an exception?
There are tragic episodes.
But not a finality. And there is no final tragedy in Sanskrit literature. And I think that's important for us to know. Well, some of the answers that we get when you ask what is the meaning of life are, life is a battle. A battle we have to wage vigorously, with courage, onward and upward, to arms. Another answer is, it's a veil of tears. A veil of tears where we have to suffer our way through, pass through the valley of the shadow, and we mourn and we weep. There are people who really love to mourn and weep and regard life as a veil of tears. And if you try to make them happy, no, I don't want to be happy. I want my veil of tears. We have a founder of our faith whose name was Sri Ramakrishna. I'm talking for our young college people who are here today. Sri Ramakrishna was about 50 years old when he passed away, so this vision came to him when he was probably in his 30s or before that. He was a holy man who lived in India. I think you probably have heard his name. And he had many visions. And the one which is most apposite for our purpose today was this one. He saw a criminal going to the block, his neck on the block, and the executioner with that wonderful shaped, what do you call that?
Scimitar.
Guillotine.
Yes.
Scimitar.
No. What?
Scimitar,
I guess you call it. Scimitar. That nice curved edge that does such a nice job on the neck. And he saw the executioner bringing the scimitar down on the criminal's head. And afterwards he told us, what was revealed to me by God in this vision? What was that the executioner, the victim, the scimitar, and the block were all one being. One being, pervading the whole process. Now what do you make of that? We believe that that same Brahman from which we came and back to which we must one day go is essential in everything in this universe, in the block, the victim, the criminal, the scimitar, and the executioner. You mean God kills God? I wouldn't put it that way, because that puts it in a personal framework. This is an impersonal understanding of divinity, of the deity. We believe in a God who is both personal and impersonal. And when you have his vision as an impersonal being, you see him as pervading the whole of everything, and no one thing can be separated from him. He has no other. He has no opposite. He has no other. And that is Sri Ramakrishna's vision. Well, let's get down to life again. Let's get back to life. Both Hinduism and Buddhism explain the purpose, the cause of life, the meaning, the source of life, origin of life, as desire. We all have desire. One of the other Upanishads that we haven't talked about this morning is the Kathaka Upanishad. And it says, that great being somehow created man with his senses turned outwards. We have been projected from that Brahman with our sense organs all turned outward. And therefore, man runs after childish things, runs after foolish things. One wise man, some sage, hearing the voice within, turned his eyes inward and discovered the Brahman within. See, that being lies within us all the time. We spend our lives foolishly pursuing the childish toys and dolls, and one wise person discovered the voice within calling him back to the source from which he came. I remember a Buddhist nun I'm talk about very often, who came to present her doctrine in the West, her doctrine of liberation through meditation and other things. This was years ago, and she was explaining Buddhist idea of rebirth, and she was trying to explain it to an old lady, and whom she didn't know very well, and the old lady said, "Oh, how wonderful. You mean I get to come back here?" Again? So, you see, you can terribly misunderstand. But it shows how strong desire is. She's at the end of her life, toothless perhaps, lame, and certainly not much to live for, but she's delighted to know that she's going to be born again. Well, that's not what we're telling you. William James said, the hell to be endured hereafter is nothing compared to the hell that we are fashioning every day here on earth. The hell to be endured afterwards is nothing compared to the hell we shall be, that we are habitually fashioning here on earth. Here's another answer. Life is a game, just a game. When I brought this up to one of the Swamis that I was serving, he said to me, "Yes, it's true, but most of us play it so badly." Same mistakes, the same passion, the same hate, the same prejudice. All of these things are coloring our perception of truth. We call it Maya. We call it the principle of delusion, the principle of misunderstanding, which I just gave to you through the example of the old lady. This is Maya. It's a nightmare. What has been created for us here in this veil of tears or this game you cannot win? Somebody else said, it's the only game the rules of which we are to discover only as we play it. Mm-hmm. It's the only game the rules of which you cannot know until it's over. Well, are you trying... This is the question we have to ask. Are you trying to wake up? Are you trying to get free of that veil? That veil, V-E-I-L, that nightmare which Maya has woven over your mind. It's a struggle, a terrible struggle. For Christ, it meant crucifixion. For the Buddha, it meant years, 6 years of terrible austerities in the forest. So, yes, there's a struggle. There's always a struggle involved. But we have to ask ourselves, are we trying to row an anchored boat? There's a story that Sri Ramakrishna tells about some drunkards who got out of the tavern late at night. And it was very dark, and they were quite drunk, and they got in the boat, and they began to row. And they rowed all night because they lived a long way away. The tavern wasn't convenient to their country place, so they had to go back to the country, and they rowed and rowed and rowed. And of course, in the morning, they found they had failed to lift the anchor. So we have anchors on our lives. Anchors are lust, passion, greed, attachment, fascination. You know them. They're all written up there in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a whole chapter on the kinds of things which keep our boat anchored. Those are the things to worry about. If it is a game, it must end with self-discovery. If you want to call it a game, the end game, the prize is self-discovery, self with a capital S, to know that your soul, yourself, is one with Brahman. Without struggle, life is insipid. Have you found the meaning of your life? Are you singing the song of life in your key? Don't try to sing the song of life in somebody else's key, in the wrong key for your voice. Sing the song of life in your key. Discord to us may be symphony to God, you know. You may think it's a terrible discord that you sing in one key and I sing in another. That's cacophony, but not maybe in God's eyes. God sees all of them as components of a wonderful symphony. And to his ear, it's not so harsh. Well, I finish with what Vedanta says about the meaning of life. I didn't tell it to you till now. Vedanta says that life has four goals. And the first of them is dharma. What is dharma? very difficult to put into English. You know, in every language there are words that you can't translate into another language, and dharma is one of them. It means fitness, righteousness, law, correct behavior, duty, uprightness. All those things. And you could add another half dozen adjectives. So the first purpose of life is to get up on a higher plane, let's put it that way. Dharma means living on a higher plane than the animal. Animals can't do dharma. Well, maybe some animals can be trained to be very selfless. I admit that. But it's man's prerogative to fulfill dharma. And the second goal, the purpose of life, is artha. Human life has to be lived in this physical world. Therefore, I need clothing, I need food, I need shelter, and the acquisition properly acquired, the accumulation properly acquired of the needs for my physical existence is called artha, A-R-T-H-A. This is what I need for my economic security. I don't have to make a fortune, but I have to become economically secure. Kama. Kama means emotional satisfaction. I have the need to relate. I've got to relate to you. I've got to relate to my forebears, to my successors. I feel now the need to relate to a successor. I'm getting that old. So, relationship. Kama means fulfilling the magnetism we all have to bring us together. In different ways, I need to have a relationship which satisfies my emotional life, which brings me into relationship with all kinds of people, then especially that intimacy, the intimate relationship of love, which is mentioned in the scriptures, sanctioned and mentioned in the scriptures. The life of intimate love is a demand that nearly every soul has to have. And the fourth is moksha, and that's where we differ from all the other formulations, perhaps, of the meaning of life. Our idea of moksha is that you have to go beyond life. Life is a series of cycles of coming and going. Round and round the squirrel goes in his squirrel cage and gets nowhere because he's going round and round in the cage. And we're doing not the same thing, because each life we hope we learn a little more than we did the previous life. But ultimately our final lesson is, it was all a big joke. I hate to say it, but I'm afraid you, it is all a big dream. I find myself in that place which is so far beyond all of the things that I could have hoped for from life or death. Mind you, suicide people are not haters of life. They don't hate life. Something deep inside them tells them, maybe I'll get a better chance. They don't say it out loud. They don't say it to their conscious mind. They say it inside themselves. Nobody terminates his life believing that that is a real termination. I promise you. So, the last lesson we have to learn is how to get freedom. Freedom from this coming and going. Freedom from the vicissitudes of dark and light, cold and heat, pairs of opposites hitting us all the time throughout life and death. And that is called freedom and Brahma-jnana, knowledge of Brahman, and Brahma-bhuta, having become Brahman. And it can be done. Greater the men, greater the women, the sages who have done it. And you know that we talk about them all the time. So, with that, I leave you to comments, questions, anything you like to discuss about what we've said this morning. Yeah, I think I saw Uma first, and then I'll come to you.
Just two quick comments. Number one, I beg to have different experience of young people as I teach them at Emory. These are 19, 20 years old,
yeah.
In their early 20s. And very surprisingly, and I was very, very happy that although not all, but some of them are very seriously inquisitive. They do want to know.
Mm-hmm.
They may come up with the answers that you mentioned, but they are aware that these are not the permanent goals. So at least there is interest.
Well, I have had students like that too. No, I've seen students like that. I don't want to be entirely negative.
People are here.
Yeah.
You know, so it is coming. And second thing about the meaning of karma. Karma includes both emotional and physical fulfillment.
Okay.
According to the original desire.
Yes. Oh, sure, naturally.
Yes.
I mentioned, when love implies that. Larry?
Well, I was just thinking of two bumper stickers.
What?
Two bumper stickers I see a lot.
Okay.
One about life is a beach, and I've always wondered whether it's Normandy Beach or Rehoboth Beach, you know, when I see it. And
What do you think they mean?
Life is a beach.
I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the other is the person with the most toys wins.
And, yeah, right. You see, these are both cynical framings of the untruth. The miserable untruth, yes?
I got a question about Swami Vivekananda's comment about the ant.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he meant that
and he wanted an ant to call.
Do you think he meant that he exists in the world for the world's benefit, like a bodhisattva, as long as there's even one speck that's not merged in Brahman, that he's around to in this life?
Oh, no, that's a possibility.
That's what I took it to mean, but then I thought maybe that he meant something entirely different, like...
Well, I didn't explain it that way.
No, I mean, I didn't know what... You didn't explain it at all. I just...
Yes, I did.
You just said he wasn't in a hurry. You explained it...
Catherine was asleep. Catherine
was asleep. He said it just when he wasn't in a hurry. But is he not in a hurry because...
Because I am everywhere.
Because he's everywhere.
Yes.
He's identifying.
He's identified with all of existence. Yeah.
Right, he's identifying himself with Brahman.
I explained it.
What it implies is like if there's no ant, if there's nothing left, then he disappears, which is also not true. If it's not the way I suggest, if it's not like that he views himself as some sort of bodhisattva, do you see what I'm saying?
It's a poetic saying. You're being very analytical. But I understand that's possible. It may be that he did also mean that. I like it, appreciate your suggestion. That so long as like Buddha, so long as a bodhisattva says, so long as any being is not liberated, I don't take my liberation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So in the similar, that's what you're suggesting. Well, it may be that he felt that. I was taking it in the highest sense, which I like, that. So long as there is an ant living, I am both life and non-life. I am I am not Swami Vivekananda, but I am everybody, every being, every living being anyway. Any other questions? Yeah. Oh, Jillian?
Swami, you have talked about the Atman being within all of us, that God is within all of us. So, and then you talked today about when we die, that sort of to not, I think you're saying not to look forward to something else. So if the Atman is within us, if we compare that with the Christian soul or spirit, what happens to the Atman? Am I misunderstanding?
No, but you've got to make a very clear distinction between what Christians call the soul and the Atman. See, we have in our doctrine, we have the terminology of Jivatman and Paramatman. That is to say, the Atman can be considered as limited, encapsulated by the individual. And if you talk about soul in Christianity, you're usually talking about that, the Jivatman. That's what Christianity means by the soul, the individual bit of consciousness, the consciousness entrapped in Maya as an individual. Now, Paramatman is the same as Brahman. Paramatman is Atman without any restrictions, without any limitations, without any Maya. You see what I'm saying? Now, how does your question fit into that? I think I've removed the question.
Yeah. Huh?
Think it over. Think about it and come back with it. I don't think you're thinking. I don't think you were making a clear distinction between the Jivatman and the Paramatman.
I'm not sure. I don't know enough about either to.
Oh yes, you do. Oh yeah, you know all about the Jivatman. Jillian is the Jivatman.
Why would I limit the universe by being me again?
Now wait a minute. What was that? Come again?
No, I was just thinking about this idea of who is. Who am I?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, when I use the word me, I'm thinking of this, of some continued existence.
Yes, Jivatman.
Ego-bound.
That's a Jivatman.
And I'm saying, why would I limit the universe by being me again?
Yeah, okay, that's a good, I'm sure you wouldn't want to.
I'm sure I would.
Now, who's next? You had a question.
About leaving our mark in this world.
What?
About leaving our mark.
Mark on the world.
In this world. And after our demise, what impact does it leave? So long as our purpose is righteous, and if we are in the confines of what we may call dharma, why do we even have to concern ourselves at all? And I mean at all. As to what impact do we leave or not, or how it is viewed afterwards. Did Swami Vivekananda ever have to worry? Did Swami Vivekananda ever have to think how he's going to be viewed after he's gone? Or Gandhiji? Or Thakur? Or any of them? I would think not at all.
Your point is that we don't have to worry about leaving a mark in the world.
No, just the opposite. We do not have to worry about how our mark is looked upon afterwards. We have to have the purpose.
Oh, we're talking about Jay
and
Guru.
We have to leave a mark. It has to be in the confines of righteousness and other attributes that you pointed out a while ago as a part of dharma.
Mm-hmm.
And thereafter, we do not have to even consider
what other people thought. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. Yes. My only point was that if you start by thinking I'm going to leave this kind of a mark on the world, you're probably you may be right, but you may be quite wrong. And if you knew what kind of a mark you were going to leave, maybe you would have acted quite differently. Isn't it? That's all.
But to that extent, what about the fact that
when you're acting, if you believe in what you're doing at that point in time, and that's the best that you can do.
Yeah, that's why I think that's what Vijay is saying. You act according to what your best lights are.
Yeah.
But as far as the mark is concerned, the mark is the mark, you know. Nothing to do with what your intentions were, perhaps. Yes?
I thought I read somewhere Swami Vivekananda said that once you're born, leave a mark in this world.
Yeah.
That's what I read. So
okay.
Say that that should be one of the purpose of your life. Mm-hmm. That when you are born, leave a mark.
Yeah. But you see, you're taking it a little bit out of context. He did say that, but he said a lot of other things about what we should do in life.
Yeah.
Not just that we should leave a mark. I'm talking about people who make it their sole purpose and nothing else, just to leave a mark on the world. I don't think that's a valid aspiration. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, no. Once you have got a purpose, which is a higher purpose, which is a spiritual purpose, then you can say, leave your mark on the world. That's a different thing. The context is different. Anybody else?
I feel compelled to tell you that the Oglethorpe's Georgia Shakespeare Festival is putting on Macbeth all this month.
Yeah.
And they do a wonderful job at the Conant Performing Arts Center in Oglethorpe.
Yeah.
So their website is georgiashakespeare.org if you want to.
Commercial.
We have to end
this with a commercial.
You're not in Shakespeare.
That's a wonderful job. They're really doing.
Are there any more comments? I think our time is.
I have one comment. From an Advaitic point of view, is it even valid to say that we come from Brahman and go to Brahman? Aren't we all Brahman?
I know. I thought of that when I chose this verse. You see, this is a wonderful verse, but it doesn't start with Advaita. It says, all this is... Yes, it does. It starts with Advaita. All this is Brahman.
Right.
And then it says, from which? And as soon as you say, from which comes forth, you have moved away from Advaita. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Of course.
I guess what one could say that Brahman is both immanent and transcendent.
Yes, yes.
It is a whole, and we are all contained in it.
Yeah. I guess. If you have
is
to
that
say,
the way to look at it?
Yeah, if you have to say anything, say that. Otherwise, don't talk.
Like Buddha.
Yeah, that's right, like Buddha. Well, we've got to close this now. May we have our visitors express their names? I know Stephanie. And who are you?
My name is Christophe.
Christophe? You're French?
Yes.
And you?
Devon?
Yeah. And what's your background?
From Atlanta.
You're from Atlanta?
My lecturer introduced me to Vedanta.
Oh.
I'm happy to be here.
And you are?
Smita.
Okay. Are you related?
No,
you are just four students in the same class. Okay. All right. I'm glad to have you. Please take back a good report and come again. We'll say our prayer. Are there any other visitors? No, we're all the same people. Not everybody knows Ted McGill. This is Ted McGill. Oh, they come there. Ted McGill is from Tennessee. He's been here before. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om. shanti, shanti, shanti. Om peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.